You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Happy New Year. Thanks for tuning in and welcome to episode 28. I hope you enjoyed the last show where we looked back over the last year and answered listener questions. We talked about some of the highlights from the first year of the podcast, and I got to take you behind the scenes on how we put the show together. It was really a lot of fun, and I appreciate all of you who wrote in to me and gave me questions that we could answer on the show. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. Today's show is sponsored by me. Have you ever had a trip and it was just kind of lousy? You had such great expectations, but then when you got somewhere, you just didn't know where to go and you felt like you were just going to one tourist attraction or tourist trap after another? Well, I've started offering a service to help you avoid that when you plan your trip to New Orleans. I'll help provide you a customized list of where to stay, what to do, eat, see, all the things we do on the podcast here, but customized for your specific trip. It includes a 20-minute discussion with me to get a sense of your preferences, when you're going to visit, your price points, all that sort of stuff. If you're interested, send me an email. My address is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. Before we get into today's show, I want to say thanks to everyone who left me a review on iTunes. We're up to 102 five-star reviews now. Thanks to Thomas Santella and to David from Memphis. Thanks also to Ms. Underbelly. I love that name. Her review is titled A Masterclass of Local New Orleans, or Local NOLA. She writes, "Far and away my favorite podcast. Mark's show is delightful, filled with insight and fun facts about life, culture, food, and all the cheeky charm that makes the Crescent City so great." She goes on to say she's a recent transplant and she loves listening to Beyond Bourbon Street. There's so many layers, so many things to do, eat, see, delicious things to taste, and so many random kooky moments that make the city magical. Mark walks you through it all episode by episode. I love the show and I recommend it to all my friends. Give it a listen. You won't regret it. Thanks, y'all. And thanks, Ms. Underbelly. I really appreciate it. These reviews, they mean so much to me. You know, it's one of the ways I can check in to make sure I'm creating the show that you all want to hear. If you haven't done it yet, please head on over to iTunes and leave me a review. 5 stars and a couple sentences would be greatly appreciated. Now, on to today's show. As I was planning out the 2017 calendar, I realized that this particular episode would be released just before the Feast of the Epiphany on January 6th, which is the start of the carnival season in New Orleans, and it just seemed like a natural to do a show about Mardi Gras at this time. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'll know I did a show on the history of carnival early on last year and another one titled The Mardi Gras Survival Guide. They're both still relevant, and you should definitely check them out if you're interested in Mardi Gras, whether you're planning a trip this year or not. For this one, I wanted something a bit different. There's one man in New Orleans who probably knows as much about Mardi Gras as anybody. In fact, he's published an annual Mardi Gras guide for more than 40 years. His name is Arthur Hardy, and I'm really excited to be able to share with you the discussion I had with him recently. You'll hear about the early days of carnival in New Orleans, when riders first started throwing beads to the crowd, and a whole lot more. One last note before we jump into the interview. We recorded just a couple days ago over at the Morning Call in City Park, which is just a great place to get your beignets and café au lait if you want to get out of the French Quarter. Unfortunately, for the first minute or so of the recording, the background noise is a little bit loud. That's what happens when you go on location, particularly in a place where there's lots of dishes and coffee cups and all that sort of stuff. But I promise, after about a minute, it gets a whole lot better. Hey, my guest today is a nationally recognized Mardi Gras expert. He publishes an annual Mardi Gras guide that's the authoritative source about carnival in New Orleans. He's been on every major television network, and he's seen all over the place during carnival, sharing his views and his unparalleled knowledge of carnival history. He's none other than Mr. Arthur Hardy. Welcome to the show, Arthur.
So happy to be here.
Hey, it's really a pleasure for me to have you with us.
Thanks.
On Beyond Bourbon Street. I want to jump in and talk about your history, but we'll hit the obvious for you and me. I've known you since I was a kid. You were actually the band director? at yes. Brother Martin High School when I was in the band.
That's a lifetime ago for both of us, I think. My earlier career.
And I understand that you went to Warren Easton High School.
I did.
And you were in the band.
I was. I was a high school trumpet player, then switched to trombone, then switched to baritone, and eventually majored in music and had to learn all the instruments. And I really enjoyed music, and especially teaching high school kids. It was a blast.
It seems to me music and food and Mardi Gras are about as New Orleans as you can get.
Doesn't get any more carnival than that or New Orleans than that, huh?
So Warren Easton, before we get into the Mardi Gras guide, so you guys enjoyed a little bit of celebrity after Katrina.
We did. The school almost didn't reopen. It took on about 8 feet of water, and the school board was thinking about not opening it. And a group of alumni, including myself, got together and said, well, let us charter it. We'll get it open. And we did. And it said remarkable success, 100% graduation rate the last 6 years in a row. And one of the biggest boosts we got was from Sandra Bullock, who decided to adopt the school. And she and I have become friends, and it's not a bad job.
That's awesome. And of course, kept the school open. And really, like you said, it's thriving now.
It's very successful. A lot of hard work, and happy to be a part of that team. And it still keeps me close to education and music and while I'm making a living doing Mardi Gras.
Well, it strikes me, too, that's a nice transition that you've been not only involved in music, but you've been an educator your whole life.
I have, yeah. And my wife was a school teacher, and my son. It's always been very important to us. And even in our publishing business, you know, I've always thought if you can make learning fun, you can educate and entertain. People learn things without even knowing it. And that's kind of been our philosophy in our publications is to, you know, how can we impart knowledge and not let people think they're working to get it? Because I've always thought the more you know, the more you can enjoy about any subject, you know. So that's part of the mission.
We're sitting here at the Morning Call in City Park trying desperately to get some cafe au lait and venues.
We will.
We'll definitely succeed at that. So you're talking about educating. Is that what led you to create the Mardi Gras Guide in the 70s?
Actually, I've always been interested in Mardi Gras. As a kid, I marched in parades as a junior high school student. And my wife and I both taught in the Catholic school system. We were looking for a way to actually make some extra money. So what is there a need for? What has nobody else done, even if it's a simple idea? And that idea that came to us was a barroom guide to New Orleans, because I knew a lot about that in college. So we actually photographed 100 old bars of New Orleans and wrote a little history of each, and that was going to be our publication. I needed money, so where are we going to get money? How about the Archdiocese Credit Union? We taught in Catholic schools. Money was available to teachers. My wife said, you know what? I don't think they're going to lend us money to write about barrooms. What else you got? So, what was the need? There had never been a Mardi Gras guide. You know, you have a TV guide to lay out a week's worth of TV viewing. Why not a Mardi Gras guide do the same thing? So that was how it was born, out of an idea just to fulfill a need. And it was a lot easier to conceive than it was to execute.
So I was in high school at Brother Martin from 84 to 88. Mm-hmm. So you guys were still in the relatively early days back then.
We started in 77, and I had been at Brother Martin since 73, and had to get the principal's permission, you know, because this was a moonlighting gig. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, Brother Donner, who was principal then, said, go ahead as long as it doesn't interfere with your job, your day job. And so they really blessed it, and they really could have stopped it right there, you know.
Sure.
Thankfully, they didn't. So we published first in 77, a little 56-page black and white book, no ads, not a lot of content. And it was a critical success, but a financial failure. It took 2-3 years to get almost to the break-even point.
Wow.
And then in 1979, our third edition, the NOPD went out, the police department went on a strike, and there was no Mardi Gras parades. So we were down in the tubes again. So I think it took us 5 years to get back to even. But I think I was more stubborn than smart, and we stuck it out, and now it's a success. But truthfully, I work as hard now as I ever did. I thought at some point I could put it on coast. You snooze, you lose. So we still work hard every day and every year.
Well, I'll come back to the police strike, but I should mention a couple of things. You can find the Mardi Gras Guide at mardigrasguide.com, mm-hmm. And you guys are also on Facebook again.
Yep, we are, and We have a new app that's going to be out very shortly, only 99 cents. Go out, buy several, please.
And so the guide, as you mentioned, while it might have had humble beginnings, now it is, in my mind, the resource for Carnival, not only for visitors, but you see people like myself and New Orleanians with it in their backpacks along the route, right?
Yeah, well, that was, again, the idea behind it is everything you need to know in a handy magazine, whether it's your first Carnival, first time you come to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, or you're a veteran. There should be something in there that you need to know about this year's parades or about history. How did we get where we are? And we've got a lot of interesting writers that do features for us each year. So I'm very proud of it. And it's sustained by newsstand sales and, of course, advertising. That's the lifeblood of any publication, particularly those that sell. We don't give ours away.
Sure.
You have to buy it. And so that means you have to have content. People don't want 100 pages of ads. Unless you have 200 pages of editorial. So we're always 60% editorial to 40% ads.
And again, it's been, as a New Orleanian, I love it. I think you certainly learn something every year. Plus, you get the updates on what's new and what's changed. And again, is the app going to have most of the similar content?
The app will have most of what's in the magazine, plus the ability to update daily as things happen. And the live links to all of the crew websites, the parade websites, and to our advertisers. And we've got some wonderful advertisers that sell products that people need and want to enjoy the Carnival season. So it's I think it's a very handy idea, the app. You know, initially, being a print guy, I was saying, who needs digital? Who needs internet? It's a lot of, it's never going to last, right? Well, now we've jumped in with all our feet.
And you and I had talked about that previously. It seems like a great transition so that you're capturing multi-generations and however people might want to consume the information.
That's right. We think take the magazine with you and enjoy the parades even more because we tell you a little bit about each parade's history and then what are they throwing this year, king and queen, celebrity name, parade route, because the routes do change.
Right.
You need to know where to go see those parades. So hopefully just about anything you need to know you find in the Mardi Gras Guide.
This is a big question, but what goes, I think particularly for people not from New Orleans, they don't really have any sense of the vastness. What goes on into putting on Carnival each year and the individual crews? How big an effort is that?
It's a tremendous effort, and you know, the police and the city basically sanction and license parades to be on the street, but they can't make it happen. They only permit it. When Hurricane Katrina struck, there was a lot of controversy. Should we have Mardi Gras 6 months after? The city could have said no, and that would have been the end of it. The city couldn't say, yeah, we're going to do it. The individual people, the parade organizations themselves, they said, we're going to do this. The city said, okay, let's see you do it. And thankfully, we did. But it's a monumental undertaking. Every organization is a nonprofit group, and they're completely autonomous. So other than knowing when and where they're going to parade, because they get parade permits, each organization kind of does its own thing. In New Orleans, corporate sponsorship is against the law. There can be no political advertising in parade. When you think about entertainment venues around the world, most are sponsored. You know, the Allstate Sugar Bowl, the Buick Open.
Sure.
This is the only entertainment venue I know of where the people are the sponsors. It's brought to you by us.
Right.
It's a party we throw for ourselves, and we're so glad visitors come and leave, empty their pocketbooks while they're here.
Well, you kind of hit on a couple of things there. One, the fact that it is sort of self-funded. So if you ride, you can easily spend $500 or a couple $1,000s.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that's a hard thing to explain to visitors. You know, for the privilege of riding on a float and wearing a mask and a costume so nobody knows who you are, as you give them $1,000 worth of gift, you got to pay money just for that privilege. We call it dues, and that's how it works, you know. And dues can be $200, can be $1,800.
Sure.
I don't know of anyone who spends less than $500 on throws, the gifts that we toss to our guests. And it's a unique experience.
How early do the Carnival crews start thinking about the theme for the season?
It always depends upon the individual organization. But, I mean, like Brex has themes 2-3 years out already planned, on the drawing board at least, not executed, of course. Some of the organizations that rent floats may not know until 6 months before the parade what their theme's going to be. The bigger budget organizations have more elaborate themes, because they own their floats and they're only going to be used once. So it just depends upon the group. But certainly there's a lot of planning that goes into it.
And so you mentioned, and you may hear us duck in and out because we got our cafe au lait and our beignets, so we're going to enjoy that. So the bigger parades, the old crews, the Rexes, they own their own floats.
Right.
So they have much more leniency, but also more work to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of flexibility there. When you're building from ground up, you can do just about anything you want. But thankfully, there are float builders who have fleets of floats that they can rent. You basically go pick out the floats you want, and that's allowed organizations that don't have big budgets still to participate in Mardi Gras. We've got 35 parades in New Orleans proper, Orleans Parish, but if you add up the adjoining parishes, about 55 parades that happen during a 12-day period. So there are some days when there are five parades going on at the exact same time.
You mentioned, so organizations, it always amazed me, organizations can rent their floats, and you can see, in theory, the same float more than once in a season.
You can, but by law in New Orleans, that float can only appear twice.
Okay.
In other areas, they're more lenient with it. But, the things that really separate our parades from others are the crowd participation events. You don't watch a Mardi Gras parade, you're in it.
Right.
And we throw tons of thousands of dollars worth of gifts off the float. And a lot of people couldn't tell you what the theme was of the parade, but they know what they caught.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. Surely, growing up here, I've seen the same float more than once. And except for the big organizations with the traditional, where you'll see the same float every year, you'd be hard-pressed as soon as the parade is over to know what you just saw.
Yeah, unless you're a traditionalist like I am and you watch it very carefully, you know. But the throws are the things that attract people, and there's so much competition between organizations now to come up with unique throws. And we've become kind of jaded. You know, we don't want cheap stuff. We want it now, and we want it big and expensive.
It is interesting that you see, particularly on Carnival or Mardi Gras Day, how many trinkets and things are on the ground.
Yep.
That if people don't catch it or it's not exactly what they want, they just leave it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And as someone that's ridden and knows what the cost is, it's really hard to watch. It's like watching nickels dollars
raining.
It's
like throwing dollar bills on the street. You know, a friend of mine who rides in five different parades, and he said people have become so picky that they'll come up the float and almost like give them an order. We need two. And he's, wait a minute, this ain't Walmart, lady. I'll tell you what I'm going to throw to you. You know, I want two logo beads. I want a pillow with an...
Right. I remember, certainly I think the throws are what make New Orleans parades unique. But when did throws first come into existence? Have we always had that with Carnival?
We don't know for sure. There's evidence that some things were thrown from some floats early on. First parade was in 1857 in New Orleans on Mardi Gras night. I'm sure nothing was thrown then. But in 1921, the Rex Parade kind of institutionalized the custom of throwing all of their members through beads, little glass necklaces. And the reason we know that, if you look at the photos of the 1920 Rex Parade, everybody has their hands folded and they're watching the floats. The next year, you can see the men on the floats with little bags full of goodies, and everybody's hands are up in the air. Throw me something, mister.
That's amazing.
So 21 is the year we can peg it as an annual institution.
And that's amazing that you can pinpoint it through photography. That's actually a great time to plug. Besides the Mardi Gras guide that you guys publish annually, you have a terrific book, Mardi Gras in New Orleans, an illustrated history.
Thank you.
And I'll put links to all that in our show notes, which will be at beyondbourbonst.com, I think /28. But if you are enjoying the conversation and you want to know even more about the history of New Orleans and want to see the pictures, your book is maybe 200-odd pages. It's a phenomenal collection of...
We put about 40 years worth of work. People said, you know, you do a magazine, you ought to do a book. Well, we did. It's now in its fifth edition. We revise it every 3 or 4 years. And in addition to a history and a lot of illustrations, we went back and researched every parade, its theme and its king and queen, the day of the parade. So all of that's in there. And that's kind of fun. And it's good for people doing research. You know, I know my grandmother was queen of Iris in the 50s, but I don't know when. Well, look in the book, because we know when.
It is an amazing sort of, you're right, you hit this split of just beautiful collection of photographs of memorabilia and actual photos, as well as just this almost encyclopedic list.
That's what it is.
In the back of year by year.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things to me there as a local often in the old line crews, say Rex, we don't know a lot about Comus because the identities are secret, but in Rex, you will see the lineage if you're looking for people's parents or grandparents.
Yes, right.
And so that's kind of, again, an interesting insider thing.
It is, and particularly for people into genealogy. You know, there's a lot of history there, and we have, I think, about 8,000 names in the index, in the encyclopedic section in the back. We also have the weather on Mardi Gras Day for about 100 years,
wow,
and a list of guest celebrities that have ridden, and that's a relatively new feature of parades having guest grand marshals. It adds something to the parade, but I don't think it's necessary anymore. The parades are so spectacular, and whoever the guest celebrity is, you know, they're passing 15 seconds and they're gone.
Sure.
That to my mind is not a reason to see the parade. The parade is the thing. And I'm a street guy. I love being out there in the middle of it with the smells and the sounds and just rubbing elbows with people. You know, it's just a great, great experience.
So you're hitting on a bunch of things I want to ask you about. One, you're referring to some of the big organizations, the Bacchus and the Endymion. We refer to them locally as Super Crews. They tend to have celebrity grand marshals.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back almost from the beginning of both of those organizations. But as I was reading through your materials, those organizations also sort of are responsible for why parades no longer paraded through the French Quarter, right?
Well, the size of the floats, 1973, the fire department, police department got together and said, we don't think safely we can have parades going to French Quarter anymore because the floats have gotten so big. And of course, big then was not what big is now.
Right.
And I really miss parades in the French Quarter. I mean, they did that from the 1850s till 1972. But I could see the safety issue. If there was a fire, you'd never get a fire truck in there.
Sure. So. And there's a lot of concerns these days about should the French Quarter be roped off even more during Mardi Gras.
And perhaps it should. Yeah.
Again, just to plug the book, but there's some wonderful pictures of the early days on Canal Street.
Oh, yeah.
And in the French Quarter that really kind of show the tightness. And, of course, I hadn't thought about your point. The floats might have been considered big, but they were tiny compared to what we see today.
I mean, the Endymion Parade, which is the largest parade in history, not just Mardi Gras, but any parade, I believe, they have a float that salutes Pontchartrain Beach, which was a wonderful amusement park that we grew up around. It has 9 tandems on it, like 300 people on this. It's not one float. It's 9 floats connected together. I mean, you know, that could never make a turn on Royal Street in the French Quarter.
And some carnival organizations maybe have 300 members.
Yeah, exactly, or less. So, but the beauty of the whole thing is, in my mind, is the diversity of the celebration. And the variety, you know, that almost anyone can participate in some level, at least at the spectator level. And there's such a variety in the kinds of organizations. There are small ones, there are gigantic ones, there are ones that cost a fortune to belong to. There's some that I couldn't get into because my grandfather wasn't a member. And then there's some that anybody can join. Many ride with men and women, some just single gender. Tremendous amount of gay participation in parades. I mean, there is literally something for everybody.
It's one of my favorite times of year, and as you know, the podcast is called Beyond Bourbon Street. But, you know, I call the podcast Beyond Bourbon Street because I was tired of the narrative of once a year on television, you see Bourbon Street,
yeah,
and nationally they like to play up this idea of nudity. But to me, and I'm curious to get your thoughts, Mardi Gras is anything but. It's so much a family and traditional
Absolute.
Kind of experience.
Like a 5-mile picnic, and it's the nudity part of Carnival actually has tamed down quite a bit since Katrina, but it's almost exclusively limited to Bourbon Street. You know, so if you're worried about bringing your kids to a Mardi Gras parade, don't be, because you're not going to see that. It's there if you want it, but that's only one day in the French Quarter, and that happens year-round, not just Mardi Gras.
True.
It's kind of like a spring break thing, really, more than a... It got associated with Carnival, I think, incorrectly, but unfortunately, it is the image a lot of people have, that if I'm going to go to Mardi Gras, I have to bare my breast to get beads. You know, how stupid is that? You know, nothing could be further from the truth.
And that was one of the reasons I was so excited to get you on the show, because, right, there's so much of this myth, and yet the Mardi Gras that you described, the Mardi Gras that I grew up, I grew up in a parade ladder. My children are growing up in a parade ladder.
It's a time when each of us can be a child again, even if just for a little while.
So, given that you are the one of the experts locally on Carnival and really nationally, what is your Mardi Gras experience typically like?
Well, up until this last year, my experience has been working on live television, covering 6 hours of parades. But I got hired away by a different television channel last year, and part of my new contract was that I could be off on Mardi Gras Day itself. So I actually, for the first time, had a chance to ride in the Rex Parade, and we'll do it again this year. And it's a unique experience for me. It's hard for people to believe that I've never ridden, but I've almost been working, so I couldn't ride. And now I've had a chance to be a part of the things I've reported on for 41 years, and I had a blast, and I'm looking forward to it again.
And we should talk about it. So that's a heck of a way to make your entry into riding.
Yeah, it ain't too shabby. When they made the invitation, I said, you betcha.
So can you talk a little bit about what is Rex, and what's the significance of Rex and the School of Design on Carnival in New Orleans?
Well, the School of Design is basically the parent organization for Rex, which throws a parade and does a magnificent ball. Rex is considered the king of Carnival. Oldest day parade, started in 1872 and gave us the colors of Carnival. And Rex is always a civic leader, and his queen is a debutante. Since Katrina, Rex has done more than just parades and balls. They have stepped up in a philanthropic way. They have something called the Pro Bono Publico, for the Public Good Foundation. And their whole effort has been to help public schools after Katrina. They've given away more than $3 million so far. And so they're not just about having fun, but they're also about doing good. And it's a wonderful thing that they do. They're not the only organization that does that, but they're probably the most prominent one.
And Rex is one of those organizations that it's not the easiest thing to get into.
No, now it is the most public of the so-called old line crews founded in the 1800s. And it's the biggest, too, so it's easier in that way. But they're pretty selective, and there's a lineage thing, you know, grandsons of founding members and all. And that's fine. You know, I have absolutely no problem with that. It is all male. It is integrated. There are no women that ride in the parade. But there are female crews that men aren't allowed in. So it's not at all discrimination. It's a selectivity by choice and by design. And, you know, if Mardi Gras was just what it was 150 years ago, exclusive, rich, white men, I wouldn't like it at all.
Sure.
But it's not that. As I mentioned earlier, there's something for everybody. And it's just not that hard to find an organization that would welcome you. Now, they can do a background check. They don't want any axe murderers. In general, there really is an opportunity for people to participate.
Well, and that's a nice transition for, it feels to me like, one, Mardi Gras is always evolving, but one of the trends we've seen certainly post-Katrina, or right at Katrina in 2005, is the explosion, really, of all female crews.
Yes. Yeah, the women have taken over. I mean, it's just amazing. I think three of the top five crews now by membership is women. And that's a relatively new thing, and even old crews like Iris, which is having its 100th anniversary this year, has like tripled in size the last 5 years. So, you know, a lot of people thought that women couldn't do a parade, and the women said, oh yeah, get out of our way, and they've just exploded, and it's just great. The Muses organization deserves a lot of credit for that. Their signature throw is a shoe, a high-heel shoe that the women decorate. They don't throw these because you could put somebody's eyes out, but they hand them out. And it's just a unique organization, and then they've been copied by other organizations. So, the growth in Carnival in general and women specifically in those organizations has been phenomenal since Katrina.
Yeah, and so for those of you not from New Orleans, maybe not familiar with the tradition, by and large, through the first, 100, 120 years of Carnival, it was pretty much a male-dominated. There were one or two female crews. Pandora, I remember, came and went, and the crew of Iris, which is still around, as you mentioned. But there weren't a lot of options. My wife wanted to ride several years ago, and we rode an Orpheus because it was one of the few choices at the time that was co-ed.
That's right.
But these days, Muses, as you mentioned, these big all-female crews are not only among the largest, they've duplicated that success of the signature throw. So traditionally, when I thought of signature throw, I thought of either the purple, green, and gold beads of Rex and the gold doubloons or the coconut
Zulu. Coconut Zulu, yeah. Well, the women have put their own slant on it, and the crew of Nyx, which really patterned itself after the Muses, their signature throw is a purse. So they've decorated purses, and those are. And it's just, I mean, there's a new African-American female crew called Femme Fatale. They have decorated compacts, ladies' compacts. Okay. So everybody's looking for their own unique angle, and who knows what's going to be next. I wish I could think of it. I'd get rich.
Of course, I guess it keeps your line of work entertaining and original as well. One of the other recent things has been these, I don't know what to call them, but the marching groups, the walking groups.
They're walking groups or marching groups, and again, Muses deserves a lot of credit for that, for having all these all-female dancing groups. And, you know, it used to be high school girls would dance, cheerleaders and all, or young vixens would dance.
Right.
But now we've got groups like the Amelia Earharts, which are women in their 50s and 60s out there just strutting their stuff and having a good time. And we've got, I don't know, about 8 different groups with anatomically appropriate names, like the,
yes.
I'm trying to think of some of the organ grinders,
right.
and
the pussy footers.
Yeah, the pussy footers. I'm trying to think of some of the others. I have it in my magazine. If I can find a copy, I'll look it up.
And once
but
again,
they really have some crazy names, and they just have a terrific amount of fun.
And
know?
that is since Katrina, right? So we have the 6'10" Stompers, which is an gosh, I need to put a picture. The 6'10" Stompers
men.
Is an all-male group in like circa 1970s running short type.
Yeah, crazy.
Satin running shorts.
And they're actually named after Section 6'10" in the Superdome. All these guys sat they dance, and you have to audition to get in. They rehearse, and but it's just another element of Carnival and a way to participate without having to spend a fortune. And again, that's the neat thing. Is there's something for everybody. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be gorgeous. You don't have to be young. And you still can participate.
That's a great point. And that's really added a flavor to Carnival and to Mardi Gras to me. When you see, and if you come to town to watch, or if you're local and you see these marching groups we're talking about, the crowd goes crazy.
Oh, yeah.
It's a participatory thing. People are dancing in the streets with them. You know, and while there's an expense to be in these organizations, it's certainly less than the expense of some of the big carnival crews, and you don't have the throws or as many throws.
Yep. Well, you know, we call it the greatest free show on earth because it's free to watch. It's not free to participate. You know, the amount of money that's spent. When I do talks around the country, particularly conventions, and try to put it all in context, it's like if you were in New York and you wanted to go to a Broadway show and you're in line for your ticket, and the actors and actresses came off the stage and put their hands in their pockets and said, no, tickets on us, put your money away, and by the way, we're going to give you a free gift to take home when it's over. And that's what Mardi Gras is, free to watch, and we give you stuff to take home. Where are you going to beat that? You know,
that's a great point. And you mentioned it both. Again, you can find the Mardi Gras Guide and the Illustrated History at MardiGrasGuide.com. But you mentioned, I think, in both of them that Mardi Gras, throughout most of its history, has really been about us. It's been a local thing. It's been a relatively new phenomenon that we looked up and said, hey, we could get tourists here to see this.
Well, what's interesting is that it is a world-class tourist attraction, but we really don't do much to promote it. You know, it's like we built it and they will come. And even if they don't come, we're still going to do it, you know. Of course, we're very glad that they do come and, as I said, open their pocketbooks while they're here. But if not a single visitor came, as was pretty much the case after Katrina, it's a party we throw for ourselves. And we even hold it on a different date this year just to screw up the tourists. Now, that's not why.
So that's a good segue I take for granted. But how do we determine the date of Mardi Gras?
Well, 47 days before Easter, and you'd have to talk to Pope Gregory about how that was fixed in 1512, I think, is when they came up with the Gregorian calendar. But it floats. It can be as early February 3rd or as late as March 9th. And, of course, this year it's the 28th. And I'm pretty sure next year is February 17th in 2018.
And so the opposite of that is, for listeners that have listened from the beginning of the podcast, you got the answer way back in one of the early episodes on the history of Carnival. But when does Carnival season begin?
It always begins on January 6th, the Feast of the Epiphany. That's the start of what we call the Carnival season. It ends on Fat Tuesday. And the story that, you know, I've always read and believe to be true is that the church kind of licensed this period of revelry to try to convince some of their pagan converts to give up some of their crazy habits. So, look, we'll let you go crazy for a little while, and that's the carnival season. Farewell to flesh. Last time to enjoy the pleasures of the flesh. But the bad news is you're going to pay for it. When Mardi Gras is over, it's Ash Wednesday, 40 days of Lent. So it's the feast before the fast. And so it always starts January 6th and then ends on Fat Tuesday. And because of that fluctuating calendar, the whole season can be as short as 28 days or as late as 63, as long as 63. So if you're a businessman like me, you want a long season because it's more days to sell stuff, king cakes, magazines, T-shirts, whatever you sell.
It certainly feels like in those years when Mardi Gras is early, you got to eat a lot of king cake in a very compressed period of time.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. But it's a big business. I mean, there's no question the amount of money that's generated here. It's impossible to measure, but it's big. It's like having several Super Bowls. We get it every year. We don't have to bid for it. There's no competition, nobody to pay. There are no licensing agencies. So although a lot of people say the official weather forecast, the official beer, no such thing. I can't call mine the official publication. You know, it just, who's going to declare that? It's like Christmas. It belongs to everybody.
You know? And you talk about that again in the guide, that you can't buy an official poster. You can buy some beautiful posters, but you can't buy an official poster.
An organization can, the official Rex poster, but there's no official Mardi Gras poster. And that's neat because it's an entrepreneur's delight. You know, it's capitalism at its best. If you've got a great idea, bring it on. You know, if you can come out with a better magazine than mine, come on, bring it on. I'll sue you. No, I'm just kidding.
And I think you do see you see creativity and you see things come and go. Just the fact that we have year-round costume shops here in New Orleans.
Yes, we do. And, of course, tuxedo shops and formal wear, it's a great business to be in at least once a year. You know, every carnival ball, and there's more than 100, requires men to be in tuxedos and women in floor-length gowns. So it's a big business. And if you, particularly if you're a lady and you go to 6 or 7 balls, you can't dare wear the same thing twice, right? So if you need 6 formal length dresses, those aren't, you know, $12 a piece.
Well, and you mentioned that we've hit just coming right after Christmas. We're recording this. You start to see it, particularly at some of the old line restaurants. You start to see the balls and the parties happening. You start to see the white tents out front of the Antoine's, for instance.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's the restaurants love it, and there's so many private affairs that are held. I mean, the king may have a party just for his court. You know, so it may only be 12 people. But they're going to drop a lot of money for those 12 people at these events. And of course, the royalty, each parade is a king and queen. And by tradition, they buy gifts for their important people. You know, that could be 100 set of cufflinks at $40 a piece. You know, I mean, it's not easy and not hard to drop quite a lot of money at Carnival if you have a position of royalty in an organization.
And if you're a student of history or a collector of any sort, you point out several of them in the Illustrated History and also in the annual Mardi Gras guide. The little pins and tokens and trinkets that they give out at the balls are really, really beautiful.
They're called favors, and just like a party favor, they're collectible. And some of these things will cost the giver, you know, $40, $50 a piece. And I have some back to the 1880s that are gone for $600 and $700 a piece now on eBay, if you can get them, you know. So it's... there are collectibles out there, and they're fine pieces of jewelry, actually.
That's amazing. Just a couple more questions, if I could. I asked my listeners for questions, and we got a couple of them answered along the way. But someone asked, why do members of Rex have full face masks during parades?
It's just part of the tradition. You're not supposed to know who's behind the mask, the secrecy of the mask. And speaking of masking, in New Orleans, it's a law that if you're on a float, you must wear a mask. It's only legal if you're on the street watching a parade to wear a mask from sun up to sundown on Mardi Gras Day itself, on Fat Tuesday.
Okay.
You're not supposed to mask any of the time. And the reason for that is obvious. You know, I mean, if you hold up a liquor store, what did it look like? I don't know. It looked like a gorilla. You know, well, no, you can't do that. You
know? It is, and it does seem like in recent years they've been better about enforcing, at least in Orleans Parish, in New Orleans, the making sure the riders are wearing their masks the whole time.
Yeah, it's kind of self-regulated because police have more important things to do, but in general people get in the spirit of it. I mean, in the wonder in people's eyes when they get this gift from somebody, who was it? I don't know. Did you know them? Maybe not. you know. And my only experience in the parade, I had trouble finding my own family members who I knew they'd be in the corner, and yet it's going so, by so fast, sure. I couldn't connect with them. Where other people I'd throw things to, and they'd look like, oh, thank you. You know that guy? No, I don't know who that is. That's kind of the joy, playing Santa Claus.
Such a sensory overload. And my experience having ridden a couple times is exactly that. There's so much going on. You think, okay, someone's going to be in the corner, Napoleon and St. Charles, but there are a couple thousand people.
Yeah, you can't see them. And you certainly can't hear them. You see the mouths moving, but you don't know what they're saying.
What do you, we've sort of hit this in passing, but what would you tell someone if they've never been to Mardi Gras? What do they need to see?
Well, it depends upon when you come, obviously. I recommend sometimes, if you can, particularly if you're a little timid, that first weekend has more parades than the second. Crowds are smaller. It's a more subdued carnival. If you're going to come for the Mardi Gras weekend, you really need to, if you can't see at all, you need to see certainly one of the super crews, Endymion or Bacchus. It breaks my heart when people leave town before the day itself. Got to see Zulu and Rex. Monday night is the best doubleheader in carnival. Proteus, Little Bitty Parade, founded in 1881, followed by super crew Orpheus, Harry Connick Jr.'s parade, with all its fiber optic line. It's like seeing three centuries of carnival back to back. But there's so much going on. I mean, the day parades are wonderful. Toth, which has a wonderful route starting uptown. Where does it stop? And that's why we do the magazine. You know, you have to pick and choose. But I tell people, try to grab as much as you can, dress comfortably, leave the gold watches at home. Pickpockets do come to town, as they do for any big events. Be smart. One of the hardest things is finding a place to use a bathroom, so good luck with that. In fact, as you know, there's a famous song called Ain't No Place to Pee on Mardi Gras Day, and that's true, my friends.
So I think it was episode 6 of the podcast. This is episode 28. We did a survival guide.
Uh-huh.
I kind of gave people handy tips, and one of them is about seriously having a plan to pee.
Oh, yeah.
One of our best tips was, if you go to the corner of Napoleon and St. Charles, there's Sacred Heart School right there, and you can get a little wristband. I think it's maybe $3 or $5 for the day.
It's worth it, and
it's a fundraiser for the men's club there, right?
Sure.
So they clean the potties, and they you get a nice place to go.
That's part of the hidden economy of Mardi Gras. St. Stephen's too rents bathroom. I mean, but rents bathroom passes. They rent parking spaces. Best hot dogs in town. A lot of these schools, fund a lot of their activities through Mardi Gras. The parents' club will work it, and it's great. But it's, the biggest message to visitors would be: expect this to be a family entertainment event. Let your hair down, have a good time, wear tennis shoes. You're not here to impress anybody. Just enjoy it, and you'll be embraced by the crowd, because I think it's genetically encoded in our DNA. We know how to have a good time and how to help other people have a good time.
You're right. Some of my best, fondest memories of Mardi Gras, the actual day, Mardi Gras Day, is talking to strangers, talking to people visiting and helping them out, right? Maybe sharing a piece of Popeye's chicken.
Sure,
maybe just sort of telling them how it goes.
It's a time when people just come together, and it's remarkable to see it. And I think I enjoy the people as much as the parades, the people watching, and just seeing the exchanges on the street. I mean, everybody's equal at a Mardi Gras parade. And you'll see two big burly guys killing each other to get a pair of beads, and then turn around and give it to some little kid who they don't know. It's just, come on, kid, you take it.
Well, I thank you so much for being on the show
today.
Sharing some of your experiences. Again, you can and you should check out MardiGrasGuide.com, where you can buy this year's edition of the annual magazine. But if you're a history buff, take a look at the Illustrated History. Again, there'll be links there. I'll put it all there. It's well worth worth the purchase price, and just so much information. Again, you'll see Mr. Hardy, Arthur Hardy, on television as we get closer to the carnival.
We'll be on
carnival.
Fox 8 every day.
And thanks again for what you do, not only for taking the time here, but I just think, gosh, Mardi Gras is so much better for having the 40-plus years of your guide
contribution. Thank you. You're very kind.
Thank you very
much. Happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras. All right. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Arthur. I grew up in New Orleans, and I love Mardi Gras. I think I know a lot about it, but I still learned a bunch of facts today. My favorite was how we can pinpoint the year Rex started throwing trinkets to the crowd based on photography. That's just very cool to me. You can find the notes for today's show over at beyondbourbonst.com/28. I'll include the links to Arthur's website where you can purchase his Mardi Gras guide and the illustrated history of Mardi Gras like we discussed on the show. Thanks so much for listening, y'all. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have an idea for a future episode or you just want to reach out to me, my email is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. We're working on future stories about the Battle of New Orleans, things to do in City Park, movies filmed in New Orleans, plus a whole lot more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.